This is a talk given by Chuck Pickron at the Polo Men's Breakfast on May 8, 2004 in Cumming, Georgia. Chuck is a retired Delta pilot and shares some of his experience in his life and as a pilot.
I am Chuck Pickron, retired from Delta Airlines a little over 15 years ago. And I guess I'm enjoying retirement. If it wasn't for the honeydews, I think it'd be a lot better. I realized after about 6 months of retirement that with the honeydews, that I really needed a job so I could rest. But I lived here in the Polo 5.5 years. We moved from Stone Mountain area, was a neighbor of Jack for several years. I have three children, a daughter and two sons. The two sons live in Delray Beach, Florida, and our daughter lives close to us here with our only two grandchildren, 5 and 6. So I would say that there's two things about being retired, is I don't have to go south anymore. We only go north unless it's an emergency. That is the number one thing. And I guess not really having a schedule other than the honeydews.
What kind of planes did you fly? What did you retire?
The last better than 10 years was captain on the L-1011 TriStar.
You know Tony and Bonnie Couch?
Oh, I know Tony well.
Yeah. Invite him to the breakfast.
I met him. He's my question.
Yeah.
Fabulous artist. You know, and he's been teaching, has seminars all over the country for years and years.
When did you go to work with Delta?
I was hired the middle of December of 55 and started class second day of January of 56. I was actually there 33 years, 2 months.
They caught you, or were you a pilot before?
Well, I was a pilot before, yeah.
In the military, is that how you first
became? I actually soloed in Mobile, Alabama, and I guess got about 10 or 12 hours. It's all I could afford over a period of a year and a half. And I was working as an aircraft mechanic, civil service, flight test section at Brooklyn Air Force Base. And finally managed to go to Embry-Riddle in Miami to flight school. And from there I applied for the airlines over the next couple of 3 years, and there was no hiring. At that time, the airlines were very small. Delta was less than 500 pilots when I was hired on. But they only hired occasionally when they needed someone died or retired or expansion. They just was not expanding at all back then.
You were hired when they got the New York run?
Before.
Before that?
Mm-hmm. We were supposed to have gotten the Miami, New York in 56. And it looked like a done deal, but there was three of the board members of the transportation of the five that was paid off, and it went to Northeast Airlines instead of Delta, and they didn't have any aircraft or even money for it.
Did you know this was C.E. Woolman?
Yes. In my estimation, one of the greatest men that ever lived, and he was probably the greatest businessman that has ever lived. He was voted for year after year after year as the top businessman of America. Received awards. But he ran a company as if every employee was his children. You could make rather big mistakes if it wasn't intentional, and you owned up to it.
What do you think he'd think about today?
He would, I guess you couldn't, no way to express what he would feel. When he ran it, and then the next couple of after him, who was brought up through Delta and were former pilots, Charlie Dawson was the first pilot hired with Delta, and he followed Mr. Wilson. It was still a great airline. It was run the way he had ran it. But I think at one time, he pretty much knew everybody by name on the airline, and there was thousands. Working for him, as long as you didn't mistreat the public and you never lied, you could count on having your job. But he wouldn't stand for either of the other. I think personally it was the greatest job that anybody could ever have had, or the greatest person to work for.
With experience with Delta, and looking at the stock report, I think Delta right now is at 5 3/8 thereabouts. Contacts and knowing people, is it worth an investment hoping that Delta is going to come back to its former glory, or...
I do not own any now. I have owned it, but I haven't in the last few years. They're in a tough situation. There are a lot of things that has to happen for them to survive, unfortunately. And 5 years ago, I would have still bet that'd be the last airline flying.
Chuck, before you left, did you see a difference in the attitude of the Delta employees?
Oh, yes. My last 5 years, I'd say, maybe seven, I started seeing a change, and it got progressively worse. And I reached the point that I couldn't hardly wait to retire to get out of it. But it wasn't but a few months that I wish I was still there because I missed it so much.
You know, Karen went to work for Delta as a flight attendant, or maybe she went to work after we moved out of the...
Yeah, it was after you moved out.
Yeah, it was after we moved out. And she spent about 7 years as a flight attendant. But during that 7 years, it got even worse.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was to the point where there was no respect between the employees. And I don't know if you had seen that earlier.
Oh, I started seeing it, yes.
I mean,
I started seeing it. We started seeing that under, the one that was...
Ron Allen.
Started seeing Ron Allen.
That's where it came from.
And the ironic thing about that, within the pilot group, as far back as 35 years or so ago, 40 years ago, we were told he was being groomed to be president someday. And everybody knew anything about him, and the word that got out is that we hated to see the day that he'd ever be there. And he almost wrecked the airline when he was determined to make it the largest airline in the world by buying Pan Am. That was a disaster.
When my daughter was there, I used to equate what was going on at Delta to what had happened at Eastern. And it seemed like Delta followed the same path and became an Eastern.
That's a good comparison. See a lot of what has happened for the last few years as to what was happening with Eastern.
Was Delta public for a long time while you were working, or did they become public, a public company?
No, they were public. Let me ask, way back.
Tell about your story with Billy Graham when he was on the plane. Remember that you told me there? You remember that?
Yeah, there was 1958, I think.
Yeah.
I was flying a trip that was on a DC-7, four-engine prop. Miami, Cincinnati, Chicago, and layover, and then back Cincinnati, Miami. We came through a day trip, through Cincinnati, and Billy Graham got on. And we had a lounge just outside the cockpit on the left side, seated four people at a table with two on each side. Well, he sat facing the cockpit by the window. But at that time, for years, we used to leave the cockpit door open. Passengers walk in and, you know, chat with us, which we enjoyed, and they enjoyed it.
While you were flying?
Oh, yeah. So he came up and spent about 2 hours in the cockpit with us. And it was some great conversation. I was co-pilot, and we normally, descending in, we would descend right at max speed on descent, as long as the air was smooth. At a 27-mile bend on US 27 north of Miami, northwest Miami, the Visual Omni range station was there. We navigated over the point. We would usually level out there at 10,000 feet at max speed, and then start using the power off and hold the altitude till they'd. It usually work out that by the time the descent and everything would work out, we just fine, almost used no power until we got all the way in and landed. And just as we leveled out there, and I was flying it, and normally I go into the instruments because I'm slowing up and keeping altitude, and so my head was in on the panel watching the instruments, and the captain just happened to be looking out. And Billy Graham had gone back already and sitting in his seat by the window. And suddenly the captain just grabbed and did this, and we went vertical just like that. And instantly a B-47 bomber missed us maybe 20 or 30 feet.
Oh, wow.
Never saw the airplane. The captain said he never saw it. He saw what he thought was a flight of geese, and it was black smoke. He didn't see it. The closure rate was so fast that by the time he made a move, it just barely missed us. We were on the airway on flight plan, and he just come barreling out of Homestead up that way, right in the airway at our altitude. After we got on the ground, Billy Graham came back to the cockpit, and he said he was looking out the window at the moment it happened. He said, "They were so close, I saw the whites of their eyes in the cockpit of that B-47. So I always felt that was at least my first miracle, I think, that God had a hand in. And I've always felt that the reason we survived that day is Billy Graham had too much to do. He had too much work for him.
Mm-hmm. You ever know Perry Hudson?
Perry Hudson? I'm not sure. Probably, you know, if I know him, if I see him. It depends on what period of time he was with the airline, and you know when he was with them.
He was with them in the late 70s. He was one of the instructors or the final people. He served in the state senate when I was in the House of Representatives. He was a great guy.
How old a person would he be now?
Ooh, Perry was right at retirement then. He passed about 10 years ago.
I was based in Miami about 22 years before I came to Atlanta. And I knew a lot of them by sight, and some of them by name. At one period of time, I knew most all of the pilots on Delta back when we were 500 pilots. And you, at that point, you just about all the flight attendants too. We started off with Delta. Your first 3 months you went through, they hired you as a pilot. And I think one of the things that, there's two things that was a great help to getting a job as a pilot with Delta. Of course, if you had the right experience. If you were born in the country and raised on a farm, very high priority. The other one slipped me right now. I can't, but it was two things that meant. So, oh yeah, the other was in the interviews. You were interviewed several times, and your final interview, of course, was with a psychiatrist that you had to go through. But with the head of employment, I had two interviews with him and an interview with the vice president of operation, the line manager of flying, and the chief pilot. But I think the thing that they wanted to hear is why you're working. They ask that question a lot. Why do you want to fly for Delta Airlines? They wanted to hear you say that you wanted to be a captain for Delta. In other words, they wanted to be sure that you wanted to move up. And I think that was one of the big factors that they... the psychiatrist was downtown Atlanta, Dr. Janice. And the main thing I remember that we took about a 500 question exam written to start with. And those exams, I'm sure a lot of you have taken them, they try to trip you up. Like one of the first questions is, do you hate your mother? And a little later it says, why do you hate your mother? Those kind of things. But after he reviews that and calls you in his office, I remember one of the first things he had to say, he says, I see you're from Southwest Alabama, farm boy down there. I said, yes, sir. He says, well, you know, if every child in the world was born and raised on a farm, it'd be a lot better world to live in. I didn't realize what he was saying until I was later flying for the airline and realized the majority of the pilots on Delta back at that time came from a farm.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting. How do you learn to fly an L-1011?
Well, you know, you don't just go out there and start.
Right.
I had to go through flight training. And years when I finished flight training trying to get on the airlines, I had supposed to have been a job in Mobile Air Service flying charter. And it wound up that I was about a 22-hour-a-day general flunky, fly a charter once in a while, and up all night servicing aircraft all day long. So a few months of that, I left that and went to crop dusting. And I knew I didn't want to do that. I was continually trying to get on the airlines, but there was no hiring. So I was 25 years old, the max age to go into Air Force pilot training. So I did that. And about halfway through, I made certain that I could get out any day I wanted. I had no obligation. And they had a rule that if you had a minimum of 24 months prior active duty service with an honorable discharge, you could go in the pilot training program and get out any day you wanted, no obligation. If you didn't have that and you quit or flunked out, you had to stay in as an enlisted person for the full commitment. I was about halfway through that when it looked like the airlines might be moving. And so I left and took the chance, and a few months later, well, I left and went back to Miami and taught flying for Embry-Riddle. A few months later, got on Delta.
Weren't the founders also crop dusters? Or did they?
Well, that's how it started, 1926, Delta Dusters in Monroe, Louisiana.
Yeah.
In 1929 was their first, June of 29 was their first passenger flight. It became a carrier.
Was that a Ford trimotor?
No, it was in the I just rode in last year. They have it in the museum. They carry it around to air shows and they give free rides. I rode in it with two of my buddies. It was flying it. They've been retired several years, and they're flying that for the company in the air shows. I got a ride in that. That's what they started in. It was, the co-pilot seat, it was a passenger seat because you just had to have one pilot. But so there was six or seven passenger, single engine, was what they started with.
One last question.
Delta 11, I just want to ask you quick. Did you fly much internationally? Did you?
My last 5 years, I flew international. And I flew the Atlanta nonstop away and back about 6% of the time by choice. I enjoyed that much more than going to Europe, about 40% of the time to Europe.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate it.
Fighter pilot, World War II Marine, and called back in the Korean War after he was with Delta. In my estimation, I'm sure you, Chuck Yeager and Bob Hoover, probably the two best known and of the greatest pilots known, supposedly. I think Jack was equally as good or better, probably the best there's ever been. He is the person that flew with no controls in the L-1011, and they survived. He wrote the procedures that became standard emergency procedure for all airlines of the world. You have to practice on your six-month or yearly checks on how to fly without your, you know, lost controls. They came out at night of San Diego, going to L.A. and into Atlanta. And unknown to him, on rotation, the airplane just kept rotating. Well, he thought he had some control, finally stopped it just above a stall. I was trying to fly it out, and he started trying doing things to get the nose down. And knowing the aircraft, and not only that, aerodynamics so well, that I always said it, he probably knew what every square inch of any airplane had ever flown was doing at any given moment. He realized right off that to get the nose down, he could had the engineer pull circuit breakers on the outboard spoilers of the wings, being swept wings, and left him the inboard ones. And he grabbed the spoil handle and pulled it, and that kills lift on the front of the wing to help get it down. He only got it down so much. And he realized a lot of other facts of the aerodynamics that he was working with to keep it flying, but he got to 14,500 feet climbing before he finally got it leveled. But his final thing that he did to get it level, he realized the canter of the engines. That the center engines cantered up, the other engines, the wing engines cantered down. So he, at the time that he went full blast on the center engine, he pulled back on the outboard engines, and that kind of helped push it to where he could start getting level, and then put it in a bank, which loses lift, the nose wants to drop. Got it level to where he could kind of keep it level. But he had reached a point, it was just getting ready to stall. And just prior to doing this maneuver, he said that he was touched on the cheek and felt like a torch had burned all the way through his cheek. And at the same time, a voice said, "My son, everything will be fine." And he said it was absolutely no mistake in who spoke. He almost lost it the second time, and when it was all gone, he was touched again, and the voice said the same. And he shot an instrument approach into L.A. They had a 700-foot ceiling, downwind, because he wouldn't come inland over the houses. He was afraid of crashing in and killing a lot of people, besides the ones on the airplane. But he managed to shoot an instrument approach and land it on the runway in L.A. But when he had put down maybe 10 degrees flaps, because under the situation, flaps can disturb the aircraft enough, the control, that you would not put down much flaps. I guess he worked with those to get them down and manage it, flying it. But when he dropped his landing gear, the airplane pitched up, and he had to suck the gear back up, and it got him way above the approach glide slope. So he starts working with it and getting it back down, and in his mind he figures that if I put the flaps down at the same time I put the gear, they'll counteract each other. And they did enough that he could kind of control it, and he got it back on and shot the approach and landed. He touched down and couldn't get the nose down. So he had to jam the brakes and slammed it down. He stayed on the brakes to keep it down until the aerodynamic flow of the air wouldn't lift it back up. Nobody on there realized, he said that they were, people were, because they had to cancel the flight, they were all upset and mad and all that. None of them ever realized what they went through, how close to death they came. And only, I feel if it, any other pilot had been flying it besides Jack, it would have crashed. And it was a problem that was within the elevator, horizontal stabilizer, control system that was a foolproof system that never had to be checked. But unknown to them, the fairings around the tail surfaces was riding water right over it. And this had been several years into the use. And it had corroded the screw jacks and all. And you got four hydraulic systems of 3,000 pounds each on that operating system. And it control it just finally, as he did his control check on the ground, when he came back, full back for the elevators up, that jack broke and just tore everything up back there and jammed everything. And he had no trim. The elevator, one of them was part up and one was full up. They proved that the airplane could not fly, no way. In the simulators, all the test pilots, everybody, nobody could fly it. But the thing that I'd always had such high regard for Jack and felt he was the best that anyone could ever be, he was, I hate to say that I have an idol outside of Jesus Christ, but as a human, he was my idol in what I always wished that I could be. But he told me years after the fact, he and I were at a retirement party and just happened to be together, no one around, and he says, I want to tell you something that I've never told a single person, not my wife, my family, not the FAA, not Delta, no one. And he told me the story about God touching him three times and told him everything will be fine. And I think that was the greatest compliment I've ever had in my life, for him to tell me that.
That is fantastic.